Spread the fire. Welcome back to SMWX. And today, we've got an incredible interview lined up for you. Have you seen this book that everyone's talking about, Balance of Power, by renowned journalist Carnita Hunter? Why, you know, break the book down when you can just speak to the author?
Thank you very much.
I think I've been trying to get you on SMWX for since SMWX started.
Ah, thank you so much. And this book is a perfect excuse
Exactly.
To chat.
When I saw the book, I was like, yes. We covered the election. Obviously, that's when we started our work. And everywhere we went, we saw you. No matter rain, shine, light, dark. You're an incredibly hardworking journalist, and it shows in this book. Before we get started, can you just take us through what it was like chronicling this transition period between the Zuma moment and the Ramaphosa moment from the perspective of a journalist?
So the thing is, right, in journalism, there's people that I like to call like runners, right? And that's what I am, a runner, right? So not running drugs, but running the news in terms of always being on the ground and always having the luxury, I think, to be out there and to be, at times where even if it's no news, to still be there. And then even in the peaks when it's elections, should to be around. And I think that was the format that my career kind of organically just went on, which now in retrospect helped me so much with this book, because things that seemed unrelated and conversations that seemed absurd 5 years ago, 8 years ago, sort of come back and say, oh, this is how it actually fits in a bigger picture.
Right.
And that for me has been invaluable when I think about, you know, the nights spent, the late nights, you know, 8 years ago, the frustration of working or having to kind of like fight your way into this journalistic space, having to wait outside Kusatu House or to, you know, cover the Mangaung conference without having a clue over what's happening, that kind of thing. And reflecting now to say that this actually was a luxury and a privilege that has enriched me as a journalist, but also enriched my work in so many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And it shows with the book, because there are a number of things that you're able to, you know, elucidate that maybe we don't have time for in the fast-paced news cycle, or we can't always refer back to, but taking a bit of a step back, it's a different journey. And I found that while I was reading it. Let's firstly just put some of the myths of what this book is aside, because people always think they know what a book is about before they've actually read it, you know. And I think one of the myths about this book is it's some kind of biography of President Ramaphosa's life. What is this book about?
This book chronicles a transition in South Africa's recent history. That's all what it seeks to do. And to appraise it analytically and critically. And that's it.
Yeah.
So there are books that chronicle Cyril Ramaphosa's life. There are books that talk about his politics, his business, and there are books about Jacob Zuma. That all exists. For me, what I felt was quite was missing at this point in South Africa's political life is the stepping back of what did this period mean. So we're talking about the transition from the end of the Jacob Zuma years to the beginning of the Cyril Ramaphosa years, because that is going to kind of define what the Ramaphosa administration means, in the same way the Polokwane moment in 2007 meant for the beginning and for the Jacob Zuma years that followed. So for me, that was absolutely important to say, okay, this is happening at lightning speed. And that's why we need to step back, okay, while still, reporting and breaking news and all of that kind of thing, to step back and say, okay, what are some of the themes that people would want to know? So today, when we have Eskom in the crisis that it is, we kind of understand Ramaphosa's decision making, or the type of people that influence his decision making, or this is his kitchen cabinet. And for me, that was more important, because we kind of knew it for Jacob Zuma because of, what the Jacob Zuma years were. But when it comes to Cyril Ramaphosa, people had no idea these are the people that he seeks counsel from. Mm. And I think that's absolutely important because, again, when you reflect on the Jacob Zuma years, and you saw, and this is just one tiny element, the Stalingrad legal strategy of Jacob Zuma, you knew Michael Halley. You know, it was Michael Halley, Jacob Zuma, Stalingrad legal strategy. That made sense. Mm. Now, when you know, things happen in court, for example, who is giving Cyril Ramaphosa advice? Mm. Who is this person? And that's what I sought to kind of to get to in a way that doesn't only chronicle things that we know, but also to go behind the scenes and dig out things that may be obvious to me as a journalist, but not obvious to you or someone on the street, you know, reading this for the first time.
Absolutely. And while you're reading it, you can almost feel the power tipping, you know, from one era, which you go back into, to the next, and you end at the start of, in many ways, this new era. And the way you open, sorry for the spoilers, people, is really brilliant because you've got what becomes like the two centers are still one
at the time.
So take us through this opening scene of yours where, in fact, President Ramaphosa is actually
a product of
exactly. The
Zuma faction of the ANC.
Yeah, because that's like, that breaks a lot of the binaries that we work within often when we speak about the factions in the ANC, for example.
Which is probably why we shouldn't be thinking as factions as absolute, because things evolve and things morph in so many ways. Mm. And the reality of it is that Cyril Ramaphosa's return to active politics was engineered 5 years prior to the point of those same people opposing him to become president. Mm. And literally taking you to a room where Ace Magoshule, which in today, when you read the news today, you would basically see Ramaphosa on one end and Magoshule, you know, black and white comparison, whatever you'd want to contrast these factions. But at the time, the engineering of, we need a deputy president for the Jacob Zuma slate. We need someone who's credible, but not too credible that will pose a threat to Jacob Zuma, as the mission at the time was fighting Kgalema Motlanthe and removing him as a threat because he dared to challenge Zuma in 2012. Mm. And so they bring this man back from politics, and little did they know that 5 years later they would be opposing him as he now dared to contest the status quo of the Zuma arrangement in 2017.
Yeah. So there are wonderful moments like that you wouldn't have necessarily known if you're just following the news cycle. And you obviously got to speak to incredible people as you're going about the journey of this book. One of the interesting people you spoke to, which I haven't seen you asked about much, was the Chief Justice.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have this little moment where you get to interview him in the wake of Ramaphosa's, and you kind of ask him this very candid question. Take us into what you ask the Chief Justice and the kind of response he gave after President Ramaphosa, you know, became elected.
So in the course of this book, but just generally, I like to ask questions that I think about and somehow is a little awkward, but sometimes it's fascinating to see the response. And before I get to this, to the Chief Justice, you know, the time, I mean, this was a long time ago that I asked Kgalema Motlanthe this question as to, like, why did you contest Zuma? Like you knew you were going to lose.
Yeah.
Why did you do it? And that was a fascinating thing for me. And so sitting with the Chief Justice,
what did he say to that, by the way?
And he said it was a principled decision that he knew he was going to lose, that it was him proving a point that we need to do away with this arranged leadership and so that's what the step that he took. I mean, obviously, he frustrated so many of his supporters by being so non-committal and all of that kind of thing. And so I thought, let me ask you, so why would you do it this way? And that was his rationale. Whether people agree with it or people doubt it or whatever, sometimes it's important to, you know, even ask, like, Mbeki about, you know, what do you think of the 9-week years? You know, that it's awkward questions, but sometimes it gives a perspective that you wouldn't necessarily have thought. So with the Chief Justice, for me, what was one of the most important questions to me was, like, at the time of your appointment, you know, of the Zuma years, I mean, we'll get to the Ramaphosa bit, was that you were the least qualified person for the job, right? And people obviously attacked the appointment.
Yeah.
And I was like, what did you make of the situation? And he says something that I was, like, you know, shocked to my core, to say, it probably was someone, meaning Jacob Zuma, appointing someone who didn't deserve the job because they thought I could have been a lekke at the apex court. And then obviously it didn't really turn out that way for him. And so that kind of realization or that type of frankness from the Chief Justice is like, oh, wow, you know. But then there are parts where the Chief Justice obviously comments on politics, where he talks about, you know, this thing of, you know, but you know, the Messiah concept of one person can fix everything. The concepts of, you know, him talking about like the slimming of the state, for example, something that Ramaphosa really, really campaigned on, that I'm going to cut the executive. And that was, people were hungry for that type of almost a superficial announcement. But that didn't even that superficial kind of political move didn't play out because Ramaphosa still kept the bloated executive. So I mean, what I learned from the Chief Justice, the conversation I had with the Chief Justice, was the broader concept of the consequences of the years of Jacob Zuma was the appointment of people in positions so that they would be beholden to the establishment of that Zuma arrangement. And then it found its ways in the Hawks, and it found its way in the criminal justice system. And to a large degree, you know, some people may even argue that Thuli Marinsela was almost like a beneficiary of this, like the Chief Justice. They just happened to, when they got to their positions, realized that there's, you know, there's the constitution, and there's something bigger than who they are and this how they got to the job. And for me, that's important now to kind of understand that that was the modus operandi then. But now when Cyril Ramaphosa appoints his best friend from childhood as the head of the State Security Agency domestic branch, why aren't we putting those same questions to him? So we can understand how nepotism and you know, the Zupta-Gupta era, what it did to state entities. So now we need to be equipped with this information as we now go forward and say, oh, that appointment has been made. So how does this fit in? This is Ramaphosa appointing his friend. Why would you want to appoint your childhood friend as the head of the SSA? And then you kind of unravel of how the SSA was actually like a, became Zuma's paraintelligence agency of his back pocket as he fought his opponents, and effectively it became a tool to fight Jacob Zuma's own battles, or whatever those battles were as the years progress. But now that empowers us, his way, with the with knowledge to say, okay, when the state, so there's a temptation for Ramaphosa to do the same, because what's stopping him from appointing his friends to head the Hawks and appointing people who are not independent and compromised to certain positions? So this kind of empowers us to say, okay, what does this mean? Or is this a repeat of what we've seen? And we've seen the consequences of how that played out. So is this going to be a repeat of that? And for me, When we discuss things like, I know this is a bit kind of all over the place, but I just feel like it's more you know, to talk about it in a more holistic way. Like
when you don't have to cut you off for ad breaks, so
thank you for IR.
Yeah, exactly.
but so when you see the appointment of Andre Dureta, for example, and you see Ramaphosa coming out and
this
saying
this is the Eskom,
CEO. And you see the president coming out and saying, but we are committed to non-racialism. And then in my book, I kind of detail a different appointment when he was appointing a chief of staff, and people was and political advisors, and people were saying to him, your political advisors are white, or your campaign is run by white people, you know, and people started drawing that kind of concern about it. And his response was, I believe sincerely in the concept of non-racialism, something that he didn't really believe in when he was in the unions, met Mandela. Mandela convinced him about it. So for me, those anecdotes of appointing a random chief of staff and arguing that we must be firm in this concept of non-racialism, and I don't have an issue between whether my political advisor is a white person or not, kind of then creates a consistency to follow, to say it's not abnormal for Ramaphosa to defend this appointment because this is his characteristic.
You can see the narrative from before.
All the examples or sure. the pattern that has been followed the sure. same way in terms of how he makes appointments. Loyalty is a very big thing for him because he has brought people into his inner circle, people who've literally been working for him when he was Secretary General at Shell House in 1996. Mm. So you know, you see that sense of loyalty. So now, yeah. when you see people, when you see Sifiso Dibengwa, for sure. example, appointed to a board of an entity, and people are like, what? And then you realize it's also consistent to who this man is. And it's not something that's abnormal or something that's just Ramaphosa making a random decision. It's the same way of him not being confrontational, of kind of maneuvering. And people often talk about this long game and the long game, but I mean, today we can have a different discussion about maybe there's no game.
this long game is taking very long.
It's taking very long. But basically, understanding that things don't happen just out of the blue. Things don't happen in isolation. And that's the trick of understanding politics, is understanding and comparing to what
sure,
was.
Sure.
So when, for example, when Jacob Zuma becomes president, he takes literally KZN and brings it to the union buildings. And people were saying to me, in different appointments, for example, there's a guy who was appointed as the head of VIP security. I mean, an irrelevant position. But yeah. I mean, this guy was with Ramaphosa back at Shanduka. Some of the people. So then someone says to me, you know, this is cadre deployed, or this is what Zuma did. It's just like this version went to private school. You know what I mean? Because you can then justify
cadre deployment with a twang.
Yeah, with a twang. Yeah. So that's what we saw in the appointment of cabinet as well. So for me, you cannot discount these things. You cannot walk into a room and look at it on face value, and you see Ramaphosa appointing a cabinet and you're like, oh, okay, this is interesting. He left out this person, but he included this person. There are things that are bigger than the announcement of today, and you see the consequences much later.
So can I ask you on that? We'll come back to the narrative that you establish in this book, but looking forward, the president is about to give State of the Nation. I think it's fair to say that his previous addresses have come in the context of a lot more hope, a lot more belief in him.
Yeah.
He had a lot more capital to work with. Whereas this speech comes at a time when people's patience is wearing a lot more thin than it has been in the past. What do you think will be going on, given your insights into, you know, the presidency that he's building, will be going on behind the scenes as he prepares for this speech?
I think that there was two mistakes made of the millions of mistakes made. Firstly, the you know, the wasting of this luxury that he had, of this optimism, this Ramaphoria.
Sure.
So he basically, took it and ran with it, not realizing that people are going to want to expect some action, right?
Mm.
Then, I mean, last year's State of the Nation, the one about the dream and the city, and people are becoming increasingly frustrated, and you cannot appease people the same way you could have appeased them, some years ago by saying, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. Because the reality of it is, if you take his first State of the Nation address, the Tuma Mina, and I talk about the concept of how Tuma Mina came.
Oh, we're coming there, don't worry.
but if you take that and you look at some of the promises he made at the time, a lot of it was fulfilled. So you talk about, the SARS inquiry, NPA, the turning around of, you know, so there was some sort of development and movement. Now come to his now officially first term as president, a lot of the promises that he made have not been fulfilled. So for example, you make this justification when you appoint this big executive that, okay, I'm appointing this big executive, but I'm going to have KPIs for ministers. Wow, it's revolutionary. You have a whole department called the Department of Performance, Monitoring and Evaluation that's entire existence is to do that revolutionary thing that you announced. And it's been almost, I don't know, how many months since the election, and there's no, ministers don't have agreements on what the expectations are. And the reality of it now is that if you're competing with a fiscus that's dwindling, so you have no latitude to announce big projects and exciting things because there's no money to fund it, number one.
Mm.
Number two is your party can't get together on one announcement that you made about the unbundling of Eskom last year.
Yeah.
And then the third thing is that you've made all of these promises and you haven't delivered on it. So what do you have to work with now for the State of the Nation address?
Yeah.
And the reality of it is that you just have to be creative with your words. and literally that was Ramaphosa in the June after he became the election. That was you had to be creative. Because the reality of it is how are you going to fix the state-owned enterprises? You have no cash to fix state-owned enterprises. What you can do is make a bold announcement to say from 740 SOEs, we're going to cut it to 350. Only for a Chacharach reporter called Conita Hunter digging and finding out that actually there's no work done on that. There's no research. There's no, you understand?
Mm.
So we literally into this territory of just repackaging promises so that you can still grip on whatever optimism is left.
Yeah.
Because the reality of it is that the state is so decayed. And you know, in the January 8th, run up to the January 8th, that's what I really saw in Kimberley.
Yeah.
What Ramaphosa had to do was he could not respond to the people of Jan Kemsdorp or the people of, Pampierstad, as to why their roads look the way it does, or why does sewerage come into their houses?
Yeah.
Because how do you respond to say, local government is completely and utterly broken. These are the steps that I'm taking to actually fix it. Because you cannot, there's so many fires to put off. How do you say I'm going to prioritize this?
Yeah.
So what does Ramaphosa do? He tells the community exactly what they've told him. So you deflect and you say, your streets are a mess. Not, hey, we're going to pump in 2 million rand to fix all of these roads in Khalashuwe. Or do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because it's easier to fixate or to just tell people what they want to hear, to say, I agree with you. And it's quite different to the Zuma years of, we have a good story to tell. You know, and that was the narrative.
Because they could trade off the capital and some of the growth that had happened in the early part of that
absolutely
period.
And the breaking of the state was happening during the time. Now the state is broken.
Yeah.
But what makes me uncomfortable is, as a president, when you speak to business leaders and when you speak to ordinary community members, why is it that you're not taking it a step further? And that's what the State of the Nation address needs to say. You cannot say that the bureaucracy is in a mess. Our civil servants, it's terrible that so many thousands of civil servants do business with the state. Where is the kind of and I hate to use the word radical, interventions in that, okay, the law is passed that it's criminalized. You've been announcing, what's this word, lifestyle audits for civil servants. It's been 2 years. You have a whole Department of Public Service and Administration. So that's what I think needs to happen in the State of the Nation address. And I think that another thing that we're ignoring, which is absolutely important to keep check on, is the creation of these para-government structures by creating SOE councils and investment envoys and a panel, 4IR panel.
Yeah.
Why do you have government departments staffed with experts, DDGs, director generals, whose job and mandate is to get policy in order and to effect that policy? But now you're creating independence from out there to reflect, for example, on the situation. And I'll go back to the State Security Agency. You had an entire Mufumadi High panel report. They are the same challenges that Mufumadi highlighted is persisting today. So what was the intervention to say, I have the Mufumadi report, what can I do to tangibly change and turn around this highly broken, highly politicized intelligence agency? And that's what's lacking. And I think, I mean, Ramaphosa is effectively halfway through his term.
This is the thing. We're so stuck in the, like, we're just starting narrative that it's 2 years.
It's 2 years. In fact, I mean, by the end of this year, it's the machinery of who's going to be the next president or Ramaphosa's second term possibilities is already going to be in place.
Can I come to that? Because another interesting chapter in your book is this question of the fight back.
Yeah.
You know, there's been a lot of talk that from the inception of Ramaphosa's presidency, there's been an attempt to sabotage, undermine, and effectively remove President Ramaphosa as soon as possible. Mm. But I think what's really interesting about your chapter is that it's not just based on, you know, I think this is going to happen. You actually detail meetings that have happened, people who are behind this process. Mm. And so I think you have quite unique insight into that process. Mm. Take us through this fight back chapter and some of the things you discovered even very early on in the Ramaphosa presidency.
So, I mean, obviously, the way Ramaphosa won NASREC probably gave rise to this fight back because it was not definitive in any way. And so that's why people who serve alongside him could have created this effort to undermine him at every single step, right? And this happens. This happens when board chairpersons have to resign. Mm. This happens when Batabile Dlamini is appointed to a board of a state entity.
Sure.
So that weakened power that he arrived with is something that's always going to be his Achilles heel. Mm. And so the fight back context is not, it's not what we see on Twitter where Pravin or anti-Pravin, you know, those kind of, you know, surface level debates, but it's a reality of people who had benefited from an entire system breaking apart that are now threatened by the system being rebuilt.
Sure.
And by no means am I saying that Ramaphosa is this person who's doing it just, you know, because Mandela was fixing the country you know, he's probably fixing the NPA for his own political gain.
Sure,
or
sure.
I mean, SARS, for example, people can argue that he appointed his own person there the same way Tom Moyane was appointed.
And to be fair, I think there is something to be... Ramaphosa has many challenges, but he is doing something very different to the Zuma era. He may not be able to fix the patient. I have doubted from the beginning. I was very much a lone voice in 2018.
In the celebration of Ramaphosa.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't think there's an agenda to fundamentally compromise the state, necessarily.
As was the case.
Right. That doesn't mean that he's going to be able to actually fix the state. You know?
Yeah.
So I think we should distinguish while at the same time being critical of the outcomes.
Absolutely. And the thing is, the thing is, that's why we can clap when you appoint a Mufumad report or a Nugent report, but then we can also criticize you when you don't implement the findings.
And this is what we need to start being able to do, right? Because I think it's been very binary, either like angel, devil. And I just don't feel like the ANC ever works when they're being praised and celebrated, because they then sit back and they're like, okay. We can chill for.
Also, we underestimate the fact that a lot of the people who serve in the Ramaphosa administration were the same architects of the destruction of the state in the Zuma years. So that's something that needs to be kept in our head. But coming back to the fight back, is that the reality of it is, as Magashule aptly put it, it's just 5 years, comrades.
Mm.
We'll be back 5 years later.
Yeah.
And when you see the discussions, especially around the state-owned enterprises, and when you see, you know, the type of fights and within the top structures of the ANC, you understand that now that 5 years has become 2.5 years.
Mm.
And so now there's this kind of emboldenedness that we wouldn't have seen maybe in 2018 that you're seeing now to say, your time is almost up. We're coming back for this.
Absolutely.
You know, someone asked, you know, and this is just random, about the re-emergence of Duduzane Zuma at the ANC event in Kimberley. And I said, I mean, the reality of it is that he can be there, and he can't because it no... People have realized that that Ramaphosa probably was a lot more talk than action.
Hmm.
And so the apprehension maybe of his first 2 years of, oh my God, they may come for me, has become, it's only 2.5 years. I can, if I fight effectively for 2.5 years, I can then become this. And I mean, it's a serious thing that people are underestimating that actually this is Ramaphosa's unity project probably is the thing that kicked him or we'd see it much later, that this unity, you know, we need everyone on board, we need to find consensus, we need to have seriously compromised people in the executive, you know, that kind of action is probably what's going to be the unraveling of him, particularly because he didn't have the luxury of this consensus thing that he likes to perpetuate,
sure.
particularly because you don't know what you're dealing with. You're dealing with people who would want to, and again, we're not doing this angels and demons situation, but like when you look at the conversations around Eskom, and I'm just using Eskom because that's the most topical thing at the moment, and will probably be the most topical thing in his State of the Nation address, that he cannot move on the unbundling of Eskom, which is so necessary to turn things around, to take the economy out of risk, because literally if Eskom fails, the country fails, and the economy fails. And so I mean, you can't do that because of this sort of fight back or this type of maneuvering, because of this weakened political power that you walked in with. And what happened in the process to that is that while he had the weakened political power, he had the luxury of the optimism of people who wouldn't usually have been optimistic for an ANC president.
Absolutely.
He squandered that.
Yeah.
And now he's only left with this fight back.
Well, I really hope that you will, you know, go and get this book, because it's filled with lots of these nuggets and stuff you wouldn't know about how this transition from one era to another happened within the ANC. But to end off, I wanted to touch on something a little different, which is being a journalist. You've also spoken a lot about the mental health of journalism and the difficulties of journalism. And I think that, you know, in our country, there's a lot of talk about the media.
Yeah.
And I think part of the reason that the narrative is where it is because journalists aren't people, you know?
Yeah.
They're people who deliver news, usually bad news, news that you don't like. And we don't actually see what it's like to be a journalist, to get up early in the morning, to face this criticism, you know, from all sides. One minute you're someone's best friend, the next minute you're their worst enemy. Take us through just, you know, why you've been a lot more public about questions of mental health and about showing how difficult it can be to be a journalist in South Africa today.
So I think that, you know, there are some people who would claim that, you know, we sort of just, you know, crybabies when you bring the issue of the importance of mental health and in the space. And the reality of it is that our predecessors were not exposed to the level of criticism, the level of trolling, the level of harassment that we are now face because of Twitter and because of social media and because of the ease of communication.
Yeah.
And the reality of it is that we are forgetting that the harassment is a media freedom issue. It really is a media freedom issue. So when people are doxxed online, when people are trolled online, this, I mean, the Bell-Pottinger era of 2016-17 literally paved way to the normalization of constant harassment of journalists.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, at a time, you know, there would be some outrage because one person was intimidated or whatever. But the reality of it is that the consequences of this is a media freedom consequence. And so when you have whoever the politician is chucking out a journalist, or it gives rise to the unprecedented trolling and unprecedented bots attacking you, and it has a human consequence to the where we've seen journalists opting to not write controversial stories, to not ask controversial questions, to not put your neck out, because a lot of journalism is putting your neck out, because it's easier to cope with the consequences of just being you know, he said, she said, journalist, then putting your neck out. And that has a fundamental consequence on media freedom and journalists' ability to ask questions that really need to be asked and probe things that really, really need to be probed. And this is across the political spectrum.
Absolutely.
Because there's bullying from the DA, there's bullying from the ANC, there's bullying from the EFF, there's bullying from the NGO space as well. And so the reality of it is,
even other journalists bullying other journalists.
Absolutely. And the consequence, and why I thought that I'm in a good space to talk about it, is because I've been through it, I've come out onto the other side, and I'm in a space in my career where I don't no longer have to prove myself.
Yeah.
So use that capital, if you will, to say, no, 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 this needs to stop. We need, and the reality of it is, when you talk about bribing journalists, unethical journalism, all the things people criticize journalism about, this is at the center of this type of harassment. Sure. And these conversations have to be held in tandem. Mm. We need to support journalists so that their journalism is ethical and you know, in line with the press code, etc. These things don't happen exclusive of each other. And I think that the era of this brave journalists and this, you know, this kind of Jesus syndrome that journalists had, I think it needs to come to an end, because the time has changed.
Mm.
And the reality of it is that we will not be able to pull off Gupta leaks.
Mm.
And because the generation that has come after me is being not supported in the way that we ought to support each other. And that's something I think that is going to be my focus maybe for the next while, to say as much as ex-journalist is courageous in and we support the questions that he asks, you know, Pravin Gordhan in a press conference, we also need to support this person to say, how are you feeling? Are you okay when he's attacked? And when, I mean, you're subject to levels of criticism.
Sure.
It does have a personal impact.
Of course.
And it becomes more and more the longer you're out in the field, the longer you do what you do. And the reality of it is that more journalists are deciding to turn away from that type of journalism, which is a bigger problem for us. And if you criticize the quality of journalism, you have to talk about mental health of journalists.
Well, we thank you for the many
times. We can continue forever.
Oh, well, we're here. I mean, you can just come
in. I'll be back.
Come in every day. We have a standing slot.
Cool.
No, thanks so much. And we thank you for continuing to stick your neck out
for the
great journalistic work you've done in our country. And for this great book, make sure you get it, Balance of Power by Carnita Hunter. And thanks so much for joining us on SMWX.
Thank you. You guys are doing great work.
Thanks for watching the content. Like, share, and subscribe on all platforms. smwx.co.za to join the WhatsApp channel. And let's build a new conversation for a new generation.